Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Joe Saul Sehy from Stacking Benjamins, and I am in the driver's seat today, which means we're going to have a lot of fun. You know, one thing that we haven't talked about yet when it comes to this thing called investing is where it belongs in the big scheme of things, because I know that we talk about different methods of investing your money, but we don't talk about the entire financial plan. So we thought we'd have our good friend and CFP Jason Hall from MyFinancialAnswers.com on. Welcome back to the show, dude.
Hey, thanks for having me again. I'm glad I didn't chase you away with the last time I came on.
Oh, very close. You came very, very close. But I didn't get to interview you.
The vote was 1.49 for getting rid of me out of three.
You're at the end of the plank, so you better dance, buddy. So let's talk about this because, you know, as a guy who's a professional in this area, you and I see the same thing, Jason, which is investors want to start off with the sexy stuff, which is investing. But you and I know there's a lot of work that has to be done before you actually pick investments.
Right. And investing is one of those double-edged swords. If you get lucky and you have these crazy outsized returns, then it can really get you to where you want to go a lot faster. The problem is, for almost everyone who's listening, that's not going to happen. In fact, you are much better off trying to do a lot of other things to help you get towards your retirement goals than trying to get outsized investment returns. And so for me, you and I were talking about this off the air, and you kept stealing the words out of my mouth. Investing is the very last piece of the puzzle. It doesn't matter what you're invested in if you, for example, don't have proper amount of insurance and you get hit by the truck and your family doesn't have any money to take care of themselves after you're gone, or you get hit by the truck and you can no longer work and you have no way of replacing your income. So there are a lot of things that I talk about with my clients long before we talk about what to invest in.
Well, let's start with that. And actually, when you say there are a lot of things that somebody can do or that they should do versus shooting for outsized returns, are you talking about like finding ways to make more money at work or saving more money from your paycheck? Are you talking about other financial planning things that they should do?
So more the former than the latter. I mean, the latter helps. So if you think about like offense and defense, defense is insurance. Defense is making sure that if something bad happens to you, that you don't go broke, that you don't wind up homeless, having to be in the food bank line, things like that. So that's what insurance is. That's what your emergency fund is. You always want to make sure that you're playing defense first, that the things that you don't think can happen to you, which invariably will when you're not prepared, you're prepared for. Just like you have homeowners insurance, but that doesn't mean that you're going to go light fire to your house, or you have renter's insurance, but it doesn't mean that you're going to go slash everything that you own and make a claim. So you want to play defense first to make sure that in the event of very bad things happening to you, your financial life isn't too negatively impacted. And then the other side of that is what you talked about first, which is the offense, which is what are the things I can do first and foremost to increase my income. I mean, your income is the biggest lever that you have in terms of your ability to save money. I mean, you can only reduce your expenses so far. I mean, unless you're just an expert at convincing all your friends to give you free food, free lodging, free everything, you can't get your expenses any smaller. It's kind of like, you know, someone once asked me if I'd rather be too hot or too cold. My answer is too cold, because I can always put on more clothes, but I can only take off so many. So the whole more income versus more frugality, there's only so far frugality can take you. And it's important, especially when you're starting out, you know, being frugal, cutting coupons, finding the deals, buying in bulk where you can. Those are all important things. But the bigger, longer term lever that you can pull is increasing your income. It is making sure that you ask for the raise at work. I mean, there are statistics, I can't tell you what they are, but women are by and large much worse at asking for a raise than men are. Even though they're both delivering the same amount of value at work, men are just much more likely to ask for a raise. So women, go out there and ask for a raise. You deserve it. And your salaries, especially as you change jobs, the salary that you get is somewhat anchored on the salary that you had before. So if you can raise the base of your salary, then those 5, 7, 9, 10% increases are now increases off of a higher base number. Or if you change jobs, I mean, one of the most common things that the HR interviewer is going to ask you is, okay, well, what were you getting paid in your last job? And obviously there are ways that you can talk around that to say, hey, you know, I'm interested in talking about the value I'm going to deliver to you at work and what that's worth to you. But sometimes they're just going to push and push and push and push and push. And you might slip and say, hey, I made whatever you make. So the higher that number is, then the more likely you are to get more at your next job.
We were talking about that on Stacking Benjamins a couple of weeks ago about somebody that OG knows who left their job, got a 25% raise working for a new company, but they really liked the company they worked for at first. And once they got the 25% raise with the new company, after they worked there for a couple of years, went out to lunch with former boss. Former boss brought them back doing the same job they were doing before, Jason, for 40% more money because they wanted them back. So they offered them 15% above what they were paid by the competitor. And this woman had actually worked in this job for over 15 years doing the same thing and just settling for these 3% raises. Once she learned to actually go elsewhere, all of a sudden she's, you know, earning 40% more with the first company that she loved working for anyway.
Yeah, you should always know what your options are. It doesn't mean that you're going to leave your job, but you should know, what's the market paying for someone who can deliver the things I can deliver? Yeah. What are the options out there? And is where I am where I want to stay forever? I think people who expect a company to take care of them and they're going to continue to climb the ladder and eventually they're going to get the retirement watch and the golden handshake and the pension, those are few and far between. I think in your career, you make your own luck. And so by delivering value, by documenting how you've delivered value, by coming up with ideas, by improving the outputs of those around you, that's how you create value. And that's how you justify earning more. I mean, a company is only going to pay you, if you really boil it down, to however much you contribute to the profitability of that employer. And so that's your job. Increase their profitability and then claim a share of it. But yeah, it's amazing how companies will pay people a lot more if they just ask, or if there's the threat of, hey, you know, I talked to company B and I really like you guys, but company B is going to pay me 25% more. What can we do to kind of close this gap?
Right. Let's move to coming up with investing. So now we're making more money. We focused on that. Now we're actually planning out our investing. We still have a long way to go toward investing. So we're bringing more money in. What do we do in the financial plan first before we actually put money on the table?
So something I'm a fan of is Paula Pant's anti-budget, which is where you say, I'm going to save a certain amount just right off the top, 20%, 30%, whatever you think you can do. And there's lots of kind of rough rules of thumb for how much you need to be saving. For example, Wade Fowl has something called Safe Min, which is the amount that you have to save for 30 years in order to retire for 30 years and cover half of your pre-retirement income with your assets. And that's 16.2%. So anywhere from 16.2% to 25 to 50, you just take that right off the top. And that goes into your saving and your investing. And then you spend the rest and you make sure that you're going to pay the rent, pay the mortgage, pay the electricity bill, pay for food, whatever else. But then you spend with whatever's in line with your values. So if you like to travel, you travel. If you like animals, then you donate to the Humane Society or you pay for your dog to go to a doggy day camp. And whatever's important to you, make sure that your spending aligns with your values so that your subconscious and your prefrontal cortex are in agreement. But that takes a lot of the thinking out of it. I mean, if you just say, hey, right off the top, every paycheck, 25% goes away into investments. I never see it. You're not tempted to spend that money. Because if we don't take actions, if we just leave the money in the bank account and we say, hey, we'll save whatever's left over at the end of the month, I guarantee you, you will find ways to spend that money and there will be nothing left at the end of the month for you to save. So it's much easier to just automate that so that you don't have to think about it and so that you prevent yourself from making bad decisions throughout the course of the month.
Well, and I like that too, because then you're not thinking about, you know, a lot of people talk about the budget and pennies. And really, when you pay yourself first, the budget is what it is, right? You've got this much money to spend. And if you live a cash lifestyle, then you only have X amount. David Chilton, the Canadian guy that the Wealthy Barber book says, budgets are baloney. People do, you know, they save what they have to and then they spend the rest if you're doing it correctly. You know, you talk about Wade Fowle's number, about the safe minimum number. But shouldn't we get more analytical than that when we're looking at our saving? I mean, shouldn't we look at what the goal is going to cost and then kind of drive the amount that we save based on that?
Right. So it's a rule of thumb. I mean, it's an established analytical rule of thumb, but it's a rule of thumb still, which says I want to have 50% of my pre-retirement income replaced by my assets that then generate income that I can spend in retirement. And it's a 30-year working, 30-year retirement. It makes assumptions about Social Security, et cetera. So when in doubt, save more. Someone who saves 50% of their income is probably going to be in really good shape no matter what. So if you want to get into the nitty-gritty and the nuts and bolts, then yes, absolutely. You need to determine, what is my lifestyle and retirement going to be? What are the things I want to do with my money? Some people want to leave money for their kids or money for their favorite charity or something like that. And there are ways that you can accomplish that either through what you save or through, for example, a low-cost permanent life insurance policy may achieve the same goal. So yes, yeah. The number of what you have to save depends on your age, depends on how much you're going to spend in retirement, what other goals you have. And oh, by the way, if you're thinking about leaving money to your kids, you will get much more pleasure out of it if you give it to your kids while you're still alive, because you're not going to be sitting there at the funeral, watching the funeral from above going, hey, I am so glad Johnny just got that inheritance.
But it's funny, you make these decisions. I mean, what we're talking about are decisions you make before you invest. And you're making these decisions before you're picking investments. You're deciding, do I want to give money to my kids or not?
Right. Yeah. Because you make certain assumptions about the returns you're going to get over time. And at least I, as a planner, tend to assume slightly more conservative returns than what the market averages have been. That gives you a little bit of room for a little bit of wiggle room so that, hey, if you wind up with more money, great. That just means that you can do more things or you have an earlier retirement window. You could retire a few more years before you thought you could. But what to me is more important is how much coal you're throwing into the oven, not necessarily how much you're trying to get out of any particular specific investment, because this is just me. This is my personal point of view. And I know a lot of people will disagree with this, but if you read studies by a man named Michael Malbison, he talks about luck in a bunch of different scenarios that usually involve skill. And so one of the examples that he uses is baseball players. So back in, let's say, 1919, there was a pretty wide disparity in the skills of baseball players. So a really good baseball player, George Herman Ruth, was miles and miles and miles and miles better than the average baseball player. And so skill played a huge part in whether or not Babe Ruth could hit home runs. Nowadays, though, the average skill of even the 25th guy on the team, the person that rides the pine all the time, is much higher. And so the difference between the most skilled baseball player and an average player is much, much less. And so in almost all circumstances, outside of a very few, like Zach Greinke, the pitcher, is awesome. Matt Harvey is awesome. But the difference between, let's say, a good player and the average player is much more determined by luck than by skill. Because there's such a small difference in actual skill that it's very, very hard to measure. The same goes with investing. If you were investing back when Benjamin Graham was investing, back in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, the difference between the average mom and pop investor and Benjamin Graham was huge. And so it was very easy for skill to take over and for you to make outsized returns because mom and pop investors didn't have access to very much information. Whereas nowadays, the average mom and pop investor can watch CNBC. They can read 10K filings. They can go to the SEC and check out everything about a publicly traded company. They can read finance boards. They can talk to their friends. And so the skill differential is much less. And therefore, returns are much more driven by luck than by skill nowadays.
Well, the returns are differences in returns.
Differences in returns, yes. So the chances that if you have really good returns or really bad returns, the reason for those really good or really bad returns in any given time period is much more due to luck than it is to skill. Now, Warren Buffett's clearly skillful. He's been doing it for decades, but he's an outlier. Most people are not Warren Buffett. And by the time you figure out you're not Warren Buffett, it's probably too late.
Yeah.
You've probably thought that you were very skillful. You got lucky a couple of times, and then you realize way too late that you weren't all that skillful and you were dragging down your returns.
Well, we go to also Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours, right? I mean, realistically, you're not going to be Warren Buffett. I think a lot of people think if I study a course for 3 weeks or use one of these programs, the, you know, green light, red light, yellow light programs, that I'm going to magically get these huge returns. And, you know, you really got to put in the 10,000 hours, and who really wants to do that?
And I would argue, so again, if we look back when Benjamin Graham was doing it, how many people were putting in 10,000 hours versus now you've got so many people who have the opportunity and the capability of putting in 10,000 hours. You have a lot more people who have put in 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
So to differentiate yourself, you probably need to be putting in 20,000 hours.
Right. And your chance of being that guy is still going to be less because there's so many other people doing what you're doing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, like all the people that are selling these, you know, I'll teach you how to invest or let me give you these options newsletters, et cetera. If they were making all the money off of that, it's just like the old real estate infomercials of the late 80s. You know, if they were that good, they'd be making money off of real estate, not off of infomercials.
Right. I was talking to Farnoosh Torabi recently, and she was talking about, you know, looking at a 6% interest rate on investments over long periods of time. And, you know, I put on my financial advisor hat that I haven't worn in a while. And I went, man, it just seems low. And so when you're looking at returns to base your decisions on before you put money into the market, right? I mean, my feeling is that if you're going to save more money, you can accept that lower rate of return. You can accept Farnoosh's 6%. But if you can't put that much in, if you're below that 16%, maybe only saving 10%, I think then the interest rate that you shoot for has to be much higher.
But if it is, you're also taking more risks. And so you have to be prepared to handle what happens if I go chasing returns, if I try and find the next Google, and instead I found the next pets.com. So I'm a fan. Yeah, 6% is a pretty good number in my book. I would rather see you change your behaviors so that you can get to the 16% saving than save 10 and, you know, go play in options or go invest in Uncle Vinny's Deli or the Socklint Farm or whatever it is that you think is going to make up the difference. I'd rather see you change your behaviors. And the thing is, there's something called hedonic adaptation. And we usually think about it in terms of having to buy new, bigger, better stuff. So I have a beater, the car next to me is a nice convertible, and I get jealous. I buy the convertible, and then a month later, the car next to me is a Ferrari, and I get jealous, and I feel like I need the Ferrari. That's a hedonic adaptation. But it works in reverse, too. So we also can adapt to what we perceive to be a negative event in our lives. And psychologically speaking, when you save money, you frame that as a loss. So we think, oh, I made $1,000 this week and I can only spend $800 of it because I have to save $200. Therefore, I've lost $200. So if you change the framing and you say, I am putting this money in a place to where I can spend it even more in the future, that helps. And then hedonic adaptation says that it doesn't take that long for us to get used to spending $800 a week as opposed to $1,000 a week. And pretty soon we don't notice. And there's something called the region beta paradox, which basically says that we think that we won't be able to deal with pain even though we're much better at dealing with it than we think we will be. So it just says we're projecting out, oh my gosh, I have to save $200 a month more. This is going to be horrible. I'm never going to live. And it's really not anywhere near that bad. It only takes us usually between 2 and 4 weeks before we're adapted to it. And we don't really notice it anymore.
That's funny. I mean, it seems like it's just forming the habit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Just changing the habit.
Once you change the habit, it's just like a diet. You know, if you've been used to eating processed foods and a lot of carbs and you move to a high fat, high protein diet for about 4 days, you're going to have what's called keto flu, ketogenic flu, where your body's going, oh my gosh, where are the carbs? How do I get energy?
Right.
And then after that, you're like, I feel great.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Like if you just do it and you establish the habit, pretty soon you don't even notice because it's a habit. It's like Charles Duhigg talks about where you build the habits to floss your teeth. How you start flossing your teeth when you haven't flossed them at all, floss one tooth at night. And then after a week, floss two teeth. And then pretty soon you're flossing all your teeth every night.
Yeah, that makes sense. When I first asked you about investing as the last thing, you talked about playing defense first, which is interesting because a lot of people, you know, don't have any defensive strategy in their portfolio. And whenever you talk to any professional, all they talk about is defense. I'm thinking about this book that I love called Trading Rules. And it's this crazy book written by a guy who's on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, if I remember right. So he's doing something, Jason, that's far more risky than 99% of the people listening to the show will ever attempt, right? And his whole book around trading rules, that like the first 25 rules he has are all defense. I mean, every single rule this guy has, we think of him as taking a ton of risk and living this trader lifestyle, and yet he's obsessed with risk. And yet you take the guy down the street, he's got a few mutual funds. The first time he thinks about risk is when CNBC says, we just had a negative 250 down on the Dow.
Right, and then he immediately sells.
Right.
Which is probably the last thing you need to do.
Right, right.
So with risk, there are usually three things you can do with it. You can accept the risk. So a good example is every once in a blue moon, an airplane falls out of the sky. Does that mean I'm not going to fly an airplane? No. Can I control anything about what happens to the airplane once it takes off? No. I just accept the risk. I can mitigate the risk. So driving at night is more dangerous than driving during the day. So what do? You have headlights. You make sure they're clean. You make sure that your car is in good working condition. You make sure that your cell phone is charged. So if something happens, you can make a phone call. And then you could insure against the risk, which is basically handing the risk to someone else who is in a better position financially to handle the risk than you are. So this is the whole thing with homeowners insurance. So where are the chances that your home is going to burn down? Probably pretty slim. But if your home does burn down, that is a significant financial impact to you. So it's better for you to let the insurance company handle those financial impacts, and you pay them a little every year in order to accept that risk for you. So yeah, I think that, and people aren't as aware of the risks that they carry as they should be. And so the one that comes to my mind, and I have a small amount of skepticism with the numbers that are put out by the insurance institutes about whether or not people can work and have to take a claim. And also with Social Security disability filing, whether or not that's truly legitimate. But where there's smoke, there's fire. And usually the numbers say about 1 in 4 people during their working career will not be able to work for 3 months or more because of some sort of disability. And so then the question is, do I accept the risk and just say, well, you know, I'm just going to go to work and it's not going to happen to me because I'm in the 75%. Do you mitigate the risk, which is I'm going to eat well, going to eat clean, I'm going to exercise, I'm going to do things that reduce the chances of me becoming disabled? And or do you insure against it, which is, hey, if I couldn't go to work tomorrow, can I afford to continue living the lifestyle that I live and also probably get the medical help that I need in order to help me in whatever situation this could be? And so most people are not in a position where they can accept the risk. Even though they do, they are doing so without really fully thinking about what are the implications of accepting that risk.
Yeah, without analyzing it.
Yeah, without knowing, hey, right, if I couldn't make money tomorrow, do I have enough assets to where my family could continue to have the same level of lifestyle that we have now? And potentially even could we afford to pay for home health care, things like that, that you don't even think about when you think about disability. And so the answer for a lot of people is they need to insure. And that cost is usually between 1% and 3% of your income per year. And so then the financial planner's job is to help with the framing so that people understand that this is an investment in making sure that if something bad happens, that I'm not compounding my misery by running out of money when I'm physically unable to work as well.
Yeah. What's funny about that is it isn't one of those three. You can also take those three and do different parts. In other words, you can mitigate the risk by saying, okay, I'm going to live a healthier lifestyle, but I'm also going to buy insurance. I'm not going to fully insure it, but I'm going to try to mitigate it and insure it. So hopefully my acceptance of a smaller disability policy than I would buy to insure all of it, that I lessen the risk that that's going to happen.
Yep. Or you could say, hey, I'm going to save more money. I'm going to make sure that I have a larger amount of assets available, so I don't need as much disability insurance, or I have enough in liquid funds to where I can delay when I actually take my disability insurance so that I can lower the premiums.
Right.
So you could do all three at once.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could say, hey, I accept the risk for the first 180 days, for the first 365 days, that I will handle those payments. I'm going to try and mitigate the risk by running every day, like a certain Stacking Benjamin's host.
So who would that be?
OG, I guess.
Yeah, it must be.
And I'm going to insure by purchasing insurance that doesn't pay for the first year.
And it's funny what I found when people do it this way, the way that you and I are talking about, and you're in the driver's seat, it is so much more fun to talk about insurance than it is just the insurance salesperson comes over to your house. You're like, oh, I probably need a term policy. Let's just buy some. Let's just use a rule of thumb and buy some. When I'm actually planning it, it makes it, I don't know, you feel like you're so much more in control.
Right. It's control. I think giving people choices and letting them see, hey, where are the range of options here? And what happens if I make a choice not to insure?
Yeah.
Let's play that out. Let's see what happens. What happens if I get the full Cadillac policy? What happens if I get one with a long period before I actually get to claim and get the income? I think that helps people feel like they're in control of the process. And really, a lot of, if you go back to thinking about the anti-budget is all about control. You're in control. You get to choose what you do with the, let's call it 75% of the money that you bring home. You can do whatever you want as long as it's legal, moral, and ethical and keeps the lights on, keeps a roof over your head, and doesn't starve your family. You get to choose. And I think a lot of people, when they think about budgeting, when they think about financial planning, they feel like they are being acted upon instead of they are acting upon the world, their circumstances, their future. It's the same when you talk about your career. You have the power to act upon the world. And when you have that mindset, it's so much more powerful. You always have choice. And so just being aware of your choices, I think, gives you a lot more confidence. It helps you take action. It helps you do the things that you need to do.
Well, speaking of choices, you, since you were on last time, you have a brand new product on the market, which is called MyFinancialAnswers.com. And this is a place where that basically helps people do what you and I have done, you as a financial advisor, me in my old job as a financial advisor would do, to actually go through these numbers. Talk about your cool new toy.
So what we tried to do with this is create basically CFP in a box where we take all of your information and we run through a billion calculations and then we determine how much do you need to be saving every year? Where do you need to be putting that money? Does it need to go in your 401k? Does it need to go in your IRA? Do you need an emergency fund? Do you pay down debts first? We answer those questions. How much insurance do you need? What order should you be tackling things? Those are all things I think if people just knew, if they could take 30 to 90 minutes, give a tool, a service, the information, and then come up with the five or six basic things that they need to do that is rigorous, that's detailed, and doesn't just take four or five little pieces of information, run through a little basic calculator and say, ta-da, here's your answer. It takes specific things into account that a lot of the online calculators just don't do. And so that's what we wanted to create. And let me be clear, We have just released it. So as with any new product release, you may encounter a bug. We hope you don't. But if you do, please let us know. We will work as quickly as we can to address your bug and get you going again. And I would say a vast majority of our users so far have been exceptionally pleased with it. They've gotten the results that they're looking for. We've had about 25% of our users so far actually change how much they're saving for either paying off debt, emergency funds, college savings, or retirement as a result of what information they've received coming out of our tool. Change. So to me, that's huge.
Yeah, change their behavior. One in four people change their behavior based on having more information.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's really cool.
So to me, that is the most powerful thing that I have seen so far is just the raw numbers of people who are changing their behavior as a result of what they're seeing our tool tell them to do.
Great. And that's myfinancialanswers.com.
Yes, myfinancialanswers.com. And we're still offering a free trial to the first 1,000 users who sign up. That is still available. And then after that, the trial will be a 60-day trial. After that, it will be $99 a year.
Excellent. Well, thanks for coming on. This is my favorite part of the show, Jason, where you go away and now I bring everybody else in the room and we talk about you.
And you say bad things behind my back and I don't get to hear about it until 2 weeks later.
Yeah, we're going to rip you. No, I'm kidding. Thanks for playing.
There's nothing left of me to rip anyway, so it's all good.
All right, and let's move into the second half of the show, our roundtable portion. And we're sad to say that Mr. Sather couldn't make it today. Andrew Sather from eInvesting for Beginners, for those of you new to the show. He'll be back with us next week. But that means you're left with the three cool people. We'll call us the cool people because Andrew's not here.
No. Let's talk about him behind his back.
That's right. And that first voice you heard was Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds. What's going on?
Not much. Just hanging out, getting ready to talk about financial planning.
I know. Isn't that exciting? Don't you have goosebumps?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's
what I like about this show, just hanging out with my money nerd friends. And speaking of nerds from the Dallas area, it's Andrea Trevelyan from Take a Smart Step.
That's me. I'm head nerd.
You are
head
the
nerd.
How thick are your glasses, Andrea?
They're contacts.
Oh. Do you have like the world's thickest contacts then, where your eyeballs are like super huge and people can't figure out why?
You want to know the funny part is I have one eye that's like really crazy bad and then one eye that's just kind of middle of the road bad.
What's up with that?
I don't know. It's the weirdest thing. My right eye is only like a -2 and my left eye is like a -4.4. Like it's like big difference.
I'm that guy who thinks he's great until I put my glasses on. And I'm like, holy crap, I'm blind because I can see fantastic now. But you know, I walk around for a couple of days without my glasses. I'm like, oh no, everything's fine. And I'm like, I should not be allowed to drive. So, yeah. But let's talk about driving your financial plan. How's that for a segue?
Oh, nice one.
Thank you very much. I worked on that all day. And Mr. Jason Hall back on the show talking about, did it surprise either of you that Jason says investing is the last thing you should do? Miranda, did that surprise you at all?
A little bit, but yeah, it kind of did.
Why is
that? Because I always think of investing as one of the first things you do as you're setting up your long-term wealth building strategy. I suppose if you're looking at your financial plan in terms of what am I going to do for the next 1 to 5 years, and that money is the last money you should probably be investing, maybe. But I was kind of surprised because when you're setting up your long-term wealth building strategy, like for retirement or something you want 20 to 30 years down the road, I think getting that investing going in the background is kind of one of the first things you ought to do. I'm not a financial planner and I have no credentials, so.
Well, that's what I was going to ask then. As a follow-up, did you agree with his approach, though, that until you have everything else in line, you really don't even know where to invest?
Yeah, to a certain degree, I agree with that. Because I'm an indexer, the way I figure it is you start investing in an index fund and then you can figure everything out while you're making money in the background with your index fund.
Yeah, it surprised me that you're an indexer. I didn't know that about you.
I know, right? Shocking.
Right. Andrea, did it surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me. Just because I do think the planning portion is so overlooked, but so incredibly critical. But I'm kind of with Miranda. I think there's a lot of value in getting started with the investing. I think in an idealistic world, we go with Jason's approach. But reality is most Americans are slow to get on the saving bandwagon. So if you wake up one day and you're like, I'm going to start saving, get in an index and then go get the rest of it done before that instinct is gone.
So just get moving directionally, because otherwise you won't move.
Right. And the power of compounding too. You know, if you decide to now's the time and you start, even if you start with investing the wrong amount, at least you've started and you've got the ball rolling, compounding has started, and then you can go back and go, okay, now let's get everything into place.
But if you don't, Andrea, sticking with you for a second, if you don't do the financial plan first, doesn't that mean that you've got this wider array of investments you have to research? Because it seems to me that if you start off with a financial plan, that really takes this huge number of investments that are out there and narrows it. So instead of having to do tons of research, you only have to do a little.
Well, and that's why I say, if you are going to start investing without a plan, without any information, the only thing you want to look at is an index investing. Because if you try to start picking all these different funds and investments and you don't know where you're going or what your allocation should be or how much you should be saving, you're going to end up making a bunch of mistakes. So if you are not going to sit down and do the plan first and you're going to start with the investing, please only start with indexes.
Miranda, Jason immediately, when I asked him about what to do first, he immediately jumped to insurance. For you, which type of insurance you think is the most important one that people should, you know, talking about what to do first, which insurance should people analyze first?
Well, this is hard because you have these things called laws that get in your way.
It's annoying.
So you should probably get auto insurance because every state requires it. And you should get health insurance because that's now the law of the land. So you need to get these types of insurance because insurance is asset protection and it can help you kind of protect against these big problematic issues that can come your way in life. But I think life insurance is also a really big one that often gets overlooked, especially by young couples. And life insurance is a big deal because it's how you provide for your family and it can provide some peace of mind. But I think rather than just focusing on one, you really do need to get that trifecta of auto, home, and life and make sure you have that squared away first.
Yeah, not only have it, but really analyze what type's best, because if you just walk into an insurance agent's place of business, you're just going to get what that insurance agent offers, you know, instead
of... Oh, for sure. Yeah, and if they're working on some sort of commission.
Right. Then insurance sold by commission? I've never heard of that, Andrea.
Yeah. I really wish our insurance industry had been structured a completely different way when it first started. But since we can't go backwards,
but is
we're stuck with what we have.
Yeah, but at that point, let's talk about that for a second. It seems to me that it's commission because of the fact that if it weren't commission, I think to myself, what would happen? I think there's a bunch of people that would just completely ignore it because the average person doesn't understand, you know, risk measurements and the chance of bad things happening. I mean, we're all optimistic about the future, right?
I actually think it's not even optimism. I think it's denial. Right. I think it kind of goes like, you know, Jason was talking about, are you in the 25% or the 75% who's going to end up disabled? Well, most people don't want to think that they're going to be one of those people. They're in denial that it could happen. So they're just not going to go take care of it because it's not them.
Is that where you'd start, is disability insurance?
My number one would be life, but disability to me is a very, very close second. Because if you get hurt and, you know, you guys had kind of talked about, you know, are you going to mitigate by being healthy? But, you know, a lot of the times you end up disabled for reasons that you can't even control, whether it's a car wreck or fall down the stairs and break your leg. Not being able to pay your bills while you can't work will quickly destroy your finances.
And actually, to that point of being healthy will mitigate a lot of this stuff. You mean you talk about the fall, the car accident, some of this stuff. The other thing is my uncle is one of the healthiest people I know, exercises every day, eats right. It's craziness. If there's somebody out there who is super, super healthy, it's my uncle. He's had cancer twice.
Oh, yeah.
And so you can live as healthy as you want, but you can't protect against some of that stuff.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. That can be genetic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting, Miranda, is something else that Jason said that I think is something a lot of people don't think about. A lot of people, especially people listening to an investing show like ours, think about how do I eke out another percent or two, right? But Jason takes this other tack that says that it's difficult to create returns. So why wouldn't you focus instead on adding more income and stuffing more money into savings? What do you think about that kind of change?
Yeah, so to a certain degree, I agree because I'm a big fan of rather than cutting costs, focus on adding income because there's only so much you can cut. And he does make a good point about the returns, because if the market's doing poorly or something happens, or if there's a catastrophic event, or if interest rates are low, all of that stuff is stuff that you personally cannot control. And so trying to create returns is going to be a losing battle. You just kind of have to take what you can get within your risk tolerance. And so focusing on adding income and savings amounts, I think, makes sense. Although I would say, to my personal opinion, it makes more sense when you're adding that income and putting more into savings, making sure that a good portion of that savings is also part of your long-term investing savings. So making sure you're maxing out your retirement account,
or that kind of thing. Yeah, putting it into place will actually has a shot at earning some money.
Right. Because I mean, it's like, if you're going to talk about how difficult it is to create returns, putting it in a traditional savings account, I'll tell you about making it difficult to create returns right there. We're all excited that maybe the Fed's going to raise rates here pretty soon as of this recording, maybe by the time this is out. Yeah. But at the same time, even if the Fed raises rates, it's still not going to be much right now. We're still going to be in a low interest rate environment because of how low things are right now.
Right. Savings account from 1% to 1.2.
Whoa. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Andrea, you're somebody that, instead of being an indexer like Miranda, has an investment strategy. And when I heard Jason talk about this, I immediately thought of you. What do you think about Jason's assertion that you can't really create returns like Benjamin Graham did? You can't create this differentiation that investors used to be able to. So why not focus on income instead?
You know, I think two things. First, I'm going to preemphasize this with, don't forget, I bucket my investments. So I actually have a very, very large indexing bucket because of the next part of, it is really, really hard to beat the market on a consistent basis. It goes back to, are you a unicorn? Are you Warren Buffett?
Yes.
Are you, you know, this great investor? So yes, I have an active trading portfolio. I actively manage it. So far, knock on wood, doing good. But I also have indexing because I also know that I can make mistakes just like everybody else. So when he says, put the emphasis on savings because it's really hard to beat returns, you do have to do that. And, you know, my active position, it's not like I pick it and then I go watch TV. You know, I'm on Morningstar.com at a minimum of once a day, checking everything out, analyzing, do I want this at this PE ratio? It isn't something to beat the market. It's not something that you can just kind of do an hour a month. So it takes extra time and energy. So if you're not going to do that, instead go index, increase your savings, decrease your expenses, and go from there.
I love that the assumption here is that your savings, your safe savings thing, is still an index fund. I love it.
Yeah. Maybe there should be a little safer thing than that. Is that what you're saying?
What?
No, you're talking to somebody whose emergency fund, except for 3 weeks worth of expenses, my emergency fund entirely is in an all market fund. That's where I keep my emergency savings.
That's crazy drunk stupid.
I like cash. I like cash. So I do have cash. I have stocks and cash. You know, I want to actually touch on the expense part of that because, you know, he was talking about the savings and investing. And I do think it's really hard to scale back on expenses, but I think the part of the expenses that you have to keep in mind is you're trying to save enough to cover your future expenses. So the lower your expenses are on an ongoing basis, the less you have to save. So if you do things like pay off debt, pay off your house, you know, kind of just reduce your basic overhead, you have to save less.
Yeah. And Miranda, I want to get back to this elephant in the room because I just said that's crazy, drunk, stupid, and I'm not sure it is. I haven't heard of somebody doing that with their savings before. It seems like, what do you do if you have an emergency and the market goes down in the same time?
I sell what I need and harvest the losses and get a tax deduction.
Okay.
I mean, I've done that before and worked for me. And really, this is not something for everybody. This is not the strategy that I recommend for the paycheck to paycheck person. What I have is I have a tiered emergency savings plan is what it is. So I have in a real live savings account with terrible, terrible yield, I keep about 3 weeks worth of expenses. Okay. So it's there. It's 3 weeks worth of expenses. And then I keep the rest of it in a taxable account, and it's an all market fund. And I just regularly put it in there. It's a part of the automatic investing plan. It pays dividends and they're automatically reinvested. And it just grows and grows and grows. And I don't know, I think I've got 6 or 7 months in there right now.
I'm thinking it's almost like Dave Ramsey's have $1,000, right? I mean, have $1,000 and 3 weeks expenses, I think would be, because his assertion is that how many emergencies are you going to have that are going to be more than $1,000? Not many.
Not a whole lot. And so what it comes down to is I've got the 3 weeks worth of expenses, and that's just there so that if something happens like immediately and I need the liquidity, I can just get to that while I'm working on selling some of the shares of the all market fund. And it just keeps building. And every now and again, if the all market fund gets too big or if, you know, something like that, then I'll maybe move the money somewhere else. But I don't see that happening anytime really soon. And in fact, I started getting to the point where after restructuring my finances recently, that I've got extra money. So now I'm putting that in another taxable account, but this is divided between bond funds and an all market fund. And that's my new travel fund. And so now, because I've got extra money, so now I'm putting it in this other thing that's a travel fund. And once again, if I have to sell something at a loss, it's a tax deduction.
Right.
I harvest that. And that's what happened almost 5 years ago. We had a little flood in our basement. We had to spend some money to dry it out, put in a sump pump, take care of all that stuff. I sold some stuff. Some of it was losses, and it ended up being a tax deduction. So I had a tax deductible emergency.
So you made lemonade out of lemons.
But you have to know your risk tolerance. You have to know where you stand, and you have to know what you can handle, because this is not something that everybody can just do and feel comfortable with.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You're doing this with your eyes wide open, where in my experience, a lot of people, what's an emergency fund, right?
Right.
I mean, you have one that's aggressive on purpose, where you thought through it. I want to stick with you, though, because you were talking about tax loss and tax harvesting. Where does a tax strategy fit into your overall investing plan? Do you start off with what tax structure you're going to use first? Like, do you decide on regular IRA versus Roth IRA first? How does the tax strategy play into your game plan?
Yeah, I started out with trying to figure out, do I want the Roth versus the traditional IRA? I picked a Roth because I like the idea of paying taxes now and then not later, because one, it's easier to deal with, right, when you're withdrawing the money during retirement, and two, taxes might go up. And even if I'm not in a higher tax bracket, taxes may go up. So it just sort of kind of goes from there. And
do you make that decision before you pick the investment? I mean, I know it's going to be an index fund, but before you decide on index fund, do you decide IRA versus Roth, or do you do, I want index fund first, and then what's the tax structure? You know what I mean? Is it chicken or egg first?
I'm really terrible because I haven't thought much about the tax.
Uh-oh.
I know, right? Basically, I'm like Roth IRA. And then for my emergency fund, I know that I can harvest losses. And because I don't have very complex finances, that's about all it is I sat down and I said, well, let's pick the Roth versus the traditional first and then decide what I'm going to put in the Roth.
Got it. Andrea, how about you? Where does the tax strategy fit in with your overall game plan?
I actually think about taxes quite a bit, mainly because I don't want to pay more than I have to.
I was like going to say mainly because you like getting angry.
I like to keep my money. So what we do is kind of, you know, max out as many retirement options as we can. But then I'm actually very conscious of where I'm making investing decisions. So, for example, in our taxable account, I focus mainly on dividend investing because the income that's kicked off of that is at a lower tax bracket. So I don't have to worry as paying as much as like an ordinary income. Same with my active trading. I have one Roth and one taxable. So when I see something that I want to do, I will look at it and go, okay, how long am I going to own this? What's the long-term plan for this investment? And then pick the account based on, you know, available cash flow and where is taxes going to impact it the least.
Okay. But are you also thinking about when you withdraw the money? Because it seems like there's that end of the stick that people don't think about at all until they get to retirement. And then they're like, oh, I got all this money in the spots that aren't the best spot.
That's the beauty of the Roth.
That our plan is to take as much income off of the taxable stuff. So when we hit retirement, stop reinvesting the dividends, take that as a portion. Attempt to leave the retirement stuff as long as humanly possible. then start with the traditional IRAs and slowly work our way down to the Roths, because the Roths can sit forever and just keep growing and growing and growing. So that's kind of our plan.
Biggest lesson from today's show that listeners should learn, Miranda?
I think what Andrea just said. I think Andrea's the retirement drawdown plan that she has is really super great. And now I'm thinking I'm going to have to go restructure my own retirement planning. So yeah, I think the most valuable thing is what Andrea just went through with her retirement drawdown.
Yeah. And you find that annoying because now it's more time spent on that. Where's that time going to come from?
But, you know, I will say that one thing you have to keep in mind with that strategy is you might hit retirement and that might slightly alter. You know, let's say 1 year you have more income or something like that, you might want to utilize a different source. But basically, by having three different options across all of those, you can better manage your taxes in retirement.
Right. Andrea, your big takeaway for listeners from today's episode?
I think the biggest thing listeners really need to keep in mind is you have to give your entire financial picture time. You can't just set it up and completely ignore it. You can't set up an investment and not ever worry about insurance. Shut off the TV once a month and go over everything and make sure you're on target. And, you know, if you spend as much time as you do watching TV or planning a vacation and just take a little bit of that and put it over to your finances, you're going to be so much further ahead.
Oh, that's crazy talk, Andrea.
I know it is. I know.
Well, thanks, ladies, for playing. If anybody listening has a question for us, we take those. Head to our website at moneytreepodcast.com. Also there, you'll find show notes for today and how to reach each of us, as well as Jason Hall, our contributor, and how to find his new program, yourfinancialanswers.com. We'll have a link to that also in the show notes. Thanks again, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.